I remember the first time I went to give them immunizations, and Alexander Schreiner, if you follow organ music, was the organist at that time for the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. He wasn't a big man. His arms were like about that big. And I'm in awe of him because on Thursdays when he would give a free organ concert at noon, I'd walk over if I could from the health department and listen. And it was a little scary because I met his wife and she said, you know, Alexander does not like shots. Great. I had to give them shots before they went on their trip. So I did my thing, you know, I slapped his arm around a bit and talked to him and popped in the needle and he's sitting there trembling. I'm all done. And he says to his wife, when's she gonna stick me? And his wife said, Alexander, it's already done. And he goes, I want you every year. And I thought, that's really a compliment. Okay, guess what I've got? A remote. I love brains that can problem solve. You know, no brain knows it all. And if you think yours does, you don't know much. It takes a village to get everything done. All right. Forgiveness. Haven't been doing this topic for very long because I had a lot to forgive. How many of you were preacher's kids? Okay. Well, the rest of you have no idea about the PK Club. Didn't matter how many people were in my dad's congregation, 200, 500, every one of them knew exactly how the preacher's daughter should behave. I remember one of the members coming up to me chewing gum and saying, you're not chewing gum, are you? Because that's not appropriate for the preacher's daughter. And I wanted to say, then why are you chewing it and being an example? But I'd done that a few times and gotten in trouble, so I kept my mouth shut. But the problem is, every one of the congregation had a different opinion about what the preacher's daughter should be doing. And you know what that feels like. And you can't meet all those expectations. And so it's real easy not to want to bother going back to a group of people that all expect something different that you can never meet. So preacher's kids are given a bad rap. Yes, we have to make choices. But I had to forgive a lot of people for that. And sometimes it wasn't easy. What counselors know is that anyone who cannot forgive themselves, to start with, and then others, are going to struggle with relationships, and they do. Dr. Herbert Benson is a wonderful, world-renowned cardiologist who studies the relationship between the heart and the brain and things like forgiveness. And he coined a term, it's copyrighted. There's something called, whoops, that's not it. Let me get used to this. I gotta go back. Here, okay, we'll get it. My brain can learn. So, there's something called the physiology of forgiveness. And those of us in the field of brain function have learned that term. It's defined as being unable to forgive other people's faults or your own is harmful to one's health. And who knew that? So the story goes, he was reading scripture one day and came across a scripture and stopped and said, wait a minute, there's a connection between forgiveness and health? I'm going to start exploring this. And that supposedly is the beginning of his research, and we're going to talk about that today. So what is forgiveness? Well, lots of definitions. Everybody has their own definition. The online dictionary says it's the process of giving up your right to retaliate toward an offender, somebody who did something to injure you mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually, sexually, financially, whatever way. And no longer feel resentment. Now, it's one thing to say, okay, I forgive you. But it's another to let go of the resentment. And that's the struggle. Catherine Ponder says, when you hold resentment toward another, you are bound to that person or conditioned by an emotional link that is stronger than steel. Forgiveness is the only way to dissolve the link and get free. And that started me on the journey of actually writing down who I had to forgive. And I think in that journey of mine, forgiving yourself for the mistakes you've made is the hardest, especially when you were a preacher's kid. Reverend Huntley says, how do you know when you have forgiven someone? And I like this definition. You've forgiven someone when he or she, ooh, I've got she in there twice. Well, there's more females than males, so that's okay. When he or she has harmless passage through your mind, you remember what was done to you, and you feel no pain. And that's been a really helpful definition for me. All right. Now, what forgiveness is not? And I think it's important to identify that because you need to know what it is not. It is not condoning bad behavior. It is not justifying somebody's behavior just because you want them not to be guilty. The 15-year-old who backed into my relatively new car without a license, having just decided he was going to take the family car out and drive. Okay, believe me, his dad's insurance paid for it and my deductible and my rental car. It doesn't condone what happened and it doesn't deny responsibility, and it's perfectly all right to get justice and recompensation. But it doesn't mean inflicting pain on others for you to seek revenge. You know, that's what the island of Corsica is known for. Generational vendettas with a lot of revenge. I was reading a book about that, and this young man came before the judge because he'd killed a kid in another family. And the judge said to him, you know, what's this business about you going over there and killing that kid in cold blood? He goes, well, Your Honor, our family doesn't like that family. And three generations ago, one of them killed one of our kids. And the judge said, and so what started this vendetta? I don't know. He said, young man, do you mean to tell me you took somebody else's life and you don't even know what started the vendetta? And you're just blindly following it? There's a lot of us that do that. We hold grudges for years and years and years. And we might not kill them, but we don't do anything to nurture them. And finally, forgiveness is not choosing to put the brain and body that's been leased to you for use on this planet in an environment where it is getting abused. That's not forgiveness. Now, there's a difference between being a victim and a survivor. Many people who have been hurt by others go around and wear their victim badge like it is a badge of honor, instead of working through it, resolving it, and letting it go. Strahan says, a victim mindset burns up norepinephrine. It's a powerful brain substance that impacts mood and that impacts how you manage stress. It stops emotional growth. It blocks recovery. It often involves a sense of helplessness and hopelessness and of being special because you've been injured. I'm special because so-and-so did something to me. Well, forgiveness has everything to do with relieving oneself of the burden of being a victim. Letting go of the pain and moving yourself from a position of being a victim to one of being a survivor. Now, as a preacher's kid, I think becoming a survivor is your badge of honor because it takes work and choice and persistence. Doesn't take anything to be a victim except being sorry for yourself. And once you become a survivor, you're able to recover, grow up emotionally, heal wounds from the injury, role model a survivor mindset, and empathize with and help others. And sometimes you can do that more effectively when you yourself have actually experienced some woundedness. Now, our scriptural model for those who are Christians is Christ. Arguably or not arguably, Christ was abused more than any one individual ever on this planet. But you never find anything in Scripture that he was ever a victim. He was always a survivor. And that's our model. So apparently, Dr. Benson was reading in the book of Psalms, and he read Psalm 103, verses 2 and 3, and basically it says this: God forgives all your sins and what? Heals all your diseases. And the story goes that Benson actually got goosebumps, and he said, I didn't know there was any connection between forgiveness and being healthy, physically, emotionally, spiritually, and so on. So he started down his journey of research. And if you look on the internet at quotations about forgiveness, I like this one from Gandhi. The weak can never forgive. Forgiveness is the attribute of the strong. An eye for an eye leaves the whole world blind. So if you're interested in some of those quotes, I think some of them are profound. And then, of course, there's Matthew 6 that says, if you don't forgive, you won't be forgiven. And every one of us has things for which we need to be forgiven. And by the way, these slides are all on my website if you want to go back and review them at any time. Now, two types of forgiveness pop up in the literature. Type 1 and type 2. Type 1 is called decisional forgiveness. Somebody does something to you that you perceive as harmful, and you decide, all right, I'm going to forgive that person. You know, one of the last things that the recorded history says that Christ said on the cross was what? Forgive them for what reason? They don't even know what they're doing. And there are many people in this world that do things that we can choose to feel hurt about, or we can say, you know, they may have been doing it on purpose. They may not even know what they were doing. They may not even realize that what they said was so hurtful. Because remember, there's no pain until your brain decides there's pain in terms of what people say to you and so on. So type one is you just make a decision. Okay, I'm going to forgive the person for that. And you respond to them differently. You know, when you pass them in the hall at school or when you pass them in the office, you don't look the other way or frown at them or stick your tongue out at them or some juvenile act. You just give up the need to try to punish them for what they did. Now, when you do large sample studies of people in forgiveness, a lot of people do number one. They'll say, okay, I'm choosing to forgive them, and when I see them, I'll be pleasant. They may not feel pleasant internally, but they're acting pleasant. And there's something to be said for that. You know, if you feel bad and you choose to smile, even though there's nothing to smile about as far as your brain's concerned, it will actually change the neurochemistry in your brain and you will start feeling better. And if you choose to laugh, you'll even get more chemicals in your brain, dopamine, serotonin, acetylcholine, that make you feel better. So you can choose to do number one, and it's important. But that's only one half of the equation. According to Worthington, he says that decisional forgiveness is an unwavering decision. meaning today you forgive them, tomorrow you don't. Yeah, maybe the next day, maybe. Okay, go back, I'll forgive them again. And sometimes you have to forgive people more than one time because it was so painful. But it's an unwavering decision. And he says that likely the interpersonal forgiveness spoken of in Matthew, we just read that, if you don't forgive others, what? You won't be forgiven. It's not because God's decided not to forgive you, he says. It refers to the fact that harboring resentment effectively blocks one's experience of even receiving God's love and forgiveness. And we believe as Christians that God is always loving all of us. But the difference is whether or not we accept that love. And if you don't accept that love, then you're going to be in a pickle. Type two is emotional forgiveness, not just thought decisional forgiveness, but emotional forgiveness. This one is tough. But remember, who can do this, the weak or the strong? Only the strong. It involves the replacement of negative and unforgiving thoughts and feelings with those that are positive, with psychophysiological changes to the brain, the heart, and the immune system. And it gives you far more benefit than just type one. Think back to the things that you have forgiven. Have you done step one and step two? Think back to the things that you haven't forgiven. Where are you on that list? Because it's very critical to your health. Humans have trouble with forgiveness. They often do it under duress. If they don't forgive, research shows they often get stuck in what's called the five R's. Recalling what you didn't like, ruminating about it, rehearsing it, telling it to everybody who will listen over and over and over again, and they're probably bored. Resent it, and then reheating it for dinner. One man came to see me and he said, you know, I made a huge mistake. I invested our total savings, $80,000, in the stock market and lost it all. And I did not talk to my wife about it, even though it was joint funds. When she found out about it, she said she forgave me. But he says, let me tell you, if I even look at her cross-eyed, next meal, she's going to go back and tell me how horrible that was. She just feeds it to me at meals over and over and over again. That's not even step one. It's certainly not step two. I love this quote that I found. Read it with me. Resentment and unforgiveness are like taking poison and expecting it to kill the other person. Do you realize that's what the research shows? It's not going to hurt them if you don't forgive them. Most of the time, they don't even think they did anything. You know, when I came down my list of things to forgive, I actually called up some people and I said, I forgive you for doing such and such. And 3/4 of the time, what do you suppose they said? I didn't do that. You're mixing me up with somebody else. And I began to read the research, and I went, you don't forgive for them. You forgive for yourself. Now think, when's the first time you were told to forgive somebody? Can you go back in memory and pick that up? If you can't, think about it this afternoon, because it was kind of an interesting journey for me. I'll tell you the first time I was told to forgive somebody. How many of you are eldest or only children? Yeah, well, it's pretty nice, wasn't it? You never had to share your birthday parties, nothing. I had the privilege of being an only child for 4 blessed years. And I got really used to it. The only grandchild on either side of the family. Good position to be in. And then my parents screwed up. And they had my brother. He was a boil on the little landscape of my life for a long time. I wanted them to send him back and keep the stork. That's how bad it was. Because in our family, boys were better than girls. And that's pretty historical in a lot of cultures. You know, men are paid more per hour even now than women are. They often have more opportunities. In my maternal family, French Catholic, 15 generations, my mother was the first college graduate. First woman ever in 15 generations in our family to go to college. I'm only a second generation college graduate, for heaven's sake. A lot of the boys did. Several of them became doctors. But that's the way it was. So I remember this little unasked for brother came home from the hospital. And people stopped by to see him. And I heard somebody say to my dad, "Well, Pastor Taylor, you finally have somebody to carry on the family name." I said, "What's the business about the family name, Dad?" "Well," he said, "your name right now is Taylor. And when you get married, you will give up that name and you will take your husband's name." And I said, "And what will my brother do?" "Oh, he'll stay as Taylor." I said, "I don't think so. I do not think so. If Taylor's good enough for him, it's good enough for me." Well, I kept it professionally anyway. So my little brother, I think he was very spoiled. He was a beautiful child. He looked exactly like my mother. Curly blonde hair, big blue eyes. I looked like my father. I mean, he wasn't a dog by any means. But when people keep saying, "You don't look like your mother. Who do you look like?" And she'd say, "Oh, she looks like her father." I began to think maybe both of us were ugly. So I had to forgive people for that, because the first 30 years of my life, all you had to do was tell me one little thing didn't look right, and I was done for a week. So we were not very flush financially back then, and I had a rag doll, not that I played with dolls much, until my little Farquhart brother showed up. I spent most of my free time, if Dad was home, in his workshop with him. And that stopped when he was born. One of the ladies in the church felt sorry for me, and she bought me one of these new dolls. Not that I played with it much, I told you. I would make clothes for it, and then I just sit it up on the bureau. Beautiful doll, china head, but it had that new kind of soft plastic skin that made it feel more like a real baby. So I had to pull a chair over to the bureau, climb up on it, put my doll there, and I liked to see it when I walked into my room. Well, one day I heard this ruckus out in the garage. I grew up in Canada, so we called it the garage. I heard this ruckus out in the garage. And that was painful when I came down to the States. My dad was transferred to New York. Upstate, and I went to Atlantic Union College, and I didn't talk like the other kids, and I didn't spell like the other kids. And it made me realize, what must it be like for people to come to another country when English is not their basic language? I thought I spoke English. I thought the United States spoke English. Our English was not the same. And that was pretty painful. Anyway, I heard this ruckus in the garage. And I walked out there, and here is little Farquhart, 4 1/2 years old. Bored, nail, he's trying to pound the nail in the board, and he's not using a hammer. He's using my doll. Holding on to the legs, whack, whack, whack. And china pieces are going everywhere. Okay, I am not a screamer, but Mom said she could have heard me a mile away. So she comes out and sees what's going on, and I'm livid. There's hardly anything that I owned that I thought was mine. She said, well, Arlene, you'll have to forgive him. He's just a little boy. I said, I'm not gonna forgive him. She said, well, I don't think he meant to. I said, Mom, he had to pull a chair over to the bureau, climb up, get my doll, go out to the garage, and start wailing away on the nail. Don't tell me that was an accident. Well, she said, it might not have been, but you still have to forgive him. I'm not going to. Well, Arlene, she said, until you forgive him, don't show up at meals. I lasted 3.5 days. Of course, I did sneak into the basement and steal some apples, but 3.5 days of apples gets old. So I marched in, sat down at the table, and she said, oh, I see you're ready to forgive your little brother. I said, I will forgive him. Well, she said, tell him that. And I said, I forgive you. Okay, that's not even step one. I mean, I said the words, but I did not mean them. And I hung on to that for years. So ridiculous. So after my brain is a little more mature, we were having Thanksgiving dinner together one day, and I said, you know, Al, I've, you know, been partly mad at you for a long time for wrecking my doll, so I'm just telling you I'm forgiving you. He goes, what doll? I said, the doll with the china head. I don't remember you had a doll with a china head. I goes, what's wrong with your memory? You were out pounding nails with it. He goes, that never happened. You're delusional. Okay, granted, at 4.5, he may not remember. But get it, you don't do it for them. You do it for you. So as I'm going through the research, and because we tend to hang on to those 5 R's, I decided I needed a visualization, something that I could picture in my mind that showed me that this was dead and gone. So I created in my mind this fabulous cemetery. And when you're doing it in your mind, cost is no impediment. So I had imported Carrara marble from Italy, statues, all kinds of stuff. And when I would forgive somebody, I would picture putting up one of Michelangelo's carvings and put a little gold plate on it and write down the date and who I was forgiving and what I was forgiving them for. And I felt pretty self-righteous about that, I can tell you. Well, guess what? I always knew where I could go back and dig it up and ruminate about it some more and rehearse it to somebody else some more. So I didn't get rid of the statues. I still have this glorious cemetery. But all the brass plaques are gone and all the statues have been moved around. So when I bury something, I don't know where to go back to find it, to dig it up. And that's been very helpful for me. But I was talking to one man, and he says, I absolutely hate cemeteries, and I hate that electricity is not working right now. Let's try it again. Well, there we go. So he says, I hate cemeteries. I don't even want to think about it. And I said, well, what do you want to do? Well, he says, I live by the St. Lawrence River. He says, and we have great, big, beautiful maple leaves, you know, the size of a dinner plate, some of them. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to metaphorically take a take this beautiful big maple leaf and I'm going to put on it what I want to forgive, and then I'm going to put it in the St. Lawrence River and watch it float away, and I know I'll never find it again. So because the brain turns everything you think, everything you say, everything you hear into pictures, and your brain is doing the same thing right now, you all have a picture of my doll in your head, whether or not you've realized it and are looking at it. Because the brain turns everything into a picture, and what that really means is that those first and second brain layers that are subconscious, they can't use language, but they can see the picture. And whatever picture you make in your brain, they tend to follow it because they think you wouldn't have made the picture if it wasn't important to you. So when you say, "I just hate that person," whatever that looks like in a picture, your face all screwed up, punching the person in the nose, whatever that looks like, makes a picture in your brain, and your subconscious sees the picture and they go, "Oh, they really don't like that person. Okay, well, let me see what I can do to help them be ugly to that person and not forgive them." And you can see the changes on a PET scan. So I encourage you, when you forgive somebody, get yourself a metaphor. If you love horses, put it on the horse's saddle and send them off into the sunset. Put it down the garbage disposal. Whatever you want to do. But the brain works best and fastest with metaphors. I think that's why the Bible is so full of metaphors, so full of stories, so that when you hear them, you can make pictures and remember them. So if you say to yourself, whatever your name is, you hate whatever and refuse to forgive it, there goes that mental picture. Now, this work comes from Dr. Wagner, and he wrote a book called The White Bear Phenomenon. I don't know if any of you ever heard it. It's very interesting. This is what he says in a nutshell. He says that if you say, well, we're not quite there yet. If you say, "Don't think about the white bear," what are you thinking about? The white bear. You cannot not think about the white bear. I was doing this with that group of freshmen at a university, and I told them, this is the research. If you say don't anything, don't think about the white bear, don't drink alcohol, don't eat candy between meals, you've created a picture in your brain, the brain misses the don't, they think that's what you want to do, and it pushes you toward that behavior. So one of the kids in the freshman class said, "Well, if you don't want me to think about the white bear, what do you want me to think about?" Brilliant question for a freshman. Brilliant question for most adults. Because when you say don't, it only tells you what not to do. It does not tell you what to do. And yet research shows almost all of us grew up hearing 9 or 10 don'ts for every do. So the teacher says, "Don't forget your homework." And what do the kids do? Forget their homework. Instead of saying, "Put your homework in your bag by the door. Remember your homework." Total different picture in the brain. So one of the other kids said, "Well, he wants us to think about the brown bear, for heaven's sake." And another kid says, "No, not a brown bear, a black bear." And so we had lots of fun with them thinking about what I wanted them to think about when I told them what not to think about. And finally, one of the kids says, hold it, you guys. What if she didn't even want us to think about a bear? There you go. So the new research, you say your first name so your brain knows who you're talking about. You tell your brain in positive present tense language what you want it to do. So if I did want to think about a bear, I would say, "Arlene, You are thinking about a white bear, and there's the picture. And you do that for everything. So a parent will say to a kid, don't touch the stove, 4 years old. What's the picture? Touching the stove, because the first picture pops up, you know, because the brain often misses don't. So the kid does exactly what the picture says, touches the stove and gets burned, and what do the parents do? Punish the kid for touching the stove. Who told him to touch the stove? The parent did, by the choice of directions. So what would you say instead of don't touch the stove? Think of the picture you want. What would you say? It's not rocket science. The stove is hot is a statement, and a four-year-old may or may not know what hot means. Four-year-old may or may not know what a burn is. They will after that, but... Do you see how difficult it is? Because we didn't grow up hearing that. It's simple. You would say, keep your hand away from the stove. What's the picture? And I'm working on it. Because I think I grew up with 100 don'ts for every do. But that has a great deal to do with forgiveness. So you say, Arlene, you forgive so-and-so. You regret it happened, but you forgive to be healthy. And your body even feels different. Now, psychoneuroimmunology, PNI, first formed about 1985 in Colorado. It's still going on. It is designed to research how your thoughts, mindset, and self-talk literally changes the chemistry in your brain. And negative thoughts change your chemistry negatively. They decrease your energy, and on and on. So, some people have said to me, well, nobody knows I'm unforgiving. It's nobody's business. I'm not saying anything about it, but I'm sure not going to forgive her. On my life, I'm not going to forgive her. Well, your brain and your body know that you're unforgiving, and that's what's most important. For this reason, you are the only person who will be with you every second of every day for as long as you live. And when you think about that, it's really, really important. So if you're harboring unforgiveness, it increases adrenaline levels, which boosts dopamine levels, because as adrenaline goes up because of anger, your body tries to counteract it with dopamine, and you actually feel better after you have an episode of anger. Nobody else around you does, but you do. So it can be really easy to become addicted to your own adrenaline, to get a shot of dopamine instead of taking a drug. And the sadness that always accompanies unforgiveness, anger and sadness are the two that typically always combine with that. There's sometimes fear that someone else will do it to you again, but it's really more the anger and the sadness. Sadness decreases the serotonin, and it is really not possible to feel good and be happy if your serotonin is low. And you can burn up your own serotonin just by being angry, just by being sad. And that will negatively impact your health. If you choose unforgiveness, on the other hand, we could spend a whole lot of time on this, you increase, well, first of all, let's do what happens for unforgiveness, because we might as well enumerate it. You increase your stress levels and muscle tension. That's where a lot of your energy goes, because it's really hard to go around with your teeth clenched. It takes energy to do that. Increased levels of adrenaline and cortisol, the stress hormones. Increased blood pressure, increased heart rate, suppressed immune system function. increased risk for depression, heart disease, stroke, and cancer. In some studies, people with terminal cancer went through a forgiveness program, and although they eventually died because they were really far along in their disease, they lived three times longer than the people who didn't forgive. Impaired neurological function, you can't remember, really have problems with memory. And the benefit of forgiving is you don't want to necessarily forget what happened, because you want to learn from everything that happens in the hope that you can avoid anything similar down the line. Not always avoidable, but some. But genuine forgiveness allows you to remember what you need to remember, but you have no pain. You have free passage through your mind. And that's pretty great. So, choosing decisional and emotional forgiveness, step one and two. This is what research shows. What will you get besides peace of mind? Healthy relationships, lower blood pressure, less anxiety, reduction in stress, fewer or lower levels of hostility, fewer symptoms of depression, a reduced risk of alcohol dependency. Remember, alcohol gives you that momentary bit of euphoria as the brain tries to compensate for the poison that alcohol is in your brain. And so you're really not having so many of those moments, so reduced risk of dependency, lower levels of substance abuse, increased compassion and kindness, a tendency to be more at peace, higher levels of mental, physical, emotional, social, and spiritual health. It's the right thing to do, because if I were flawless, that would be one thing, but no human being is. So because people need to forgive me for things, most of which I didn't mean any harm by, because my position in life is sort of like the Hippocratic Oath that doctors take in medical school. Do no harm. As they're trying to take care of people. Do no harm. I want to never do harm to somebody else. But everybody interprets what you do differently. So we all make mistakes. And therefore, I need to forgive even as I need to be forgiven. And to receive forgiveness, I want to be open to the love of God, because it's not blocked by unforgiveness. To preserve my health, I enumerated just a few of the downsides of unforgiveness in terms of health. Increased risk, cancer, stroke, heart attack. I'm not going there if I can help it. And to keep your energy levels positive, the first thing you do, the first thing I do in the morning is find something to be thankful for immediately and affirm something positively. There's research that shows if you do that first thing in the morning, you will have more energy all day long. It's that impactful. And finally, and this is healthy selfishness. Healthy selfishness is you take the best care you can of the brain and body that have been leased to you for use on this planet. So you forgive because you benefit the most. It's great to tell other people you're forgiving them. Most of the time, they don't think they needed it. You forgive for you and your health benefits. So here's the steps. Memorize them. Well, actually, read them with me. You know, when you do PET scans, positron emission tomography, and you watch the brain functioning while the person's still alive, not after they're dead and you've sliced it all up and tried to learn what you can actually see changes in the brain based on mindset and what you tell yourself and the pictures those create. So they've also found, they were doing a PET scan, and they asked somebody, read this paragraph silently to yourself.
And in the, there's a big camera that goes around the person's head. They're injected with some glucose, some of which is a little radioactive. And when you ask the subject to do something, and the cells in the brain that lets them do that start functioning, you can actually see that in the brain. It's fascinating. So they had this guy read this paragraph silently to himself, and a little bit in the left hemisphere lit up. You know, Wernicke's area down here and behind your left cheek, the lower part of the left hemisphere, allows you to read something and make sense of it. It allows you to hear speech and translate it into something that has meaning. This wasn't part of the experiment, but one of the physicians said, why don't you ask him to read it out loud and see if anything different happens in the brain? And guess what? The whole brain lit up. Not only the part that was reading, but Broca's area up here behind your left eye that allows you to speak audibly. The feelings, the emotions that can be triggered in the right hemisphere, depending on what the reading is about. You use your lips, your tongue, your teeth, your voice box. You hear and process everything through sound in both of the temporal lobes. The whole brain is alive. That started them down another research project, which is why I mentioned. If there's something you really want to remember, read it aloud. So let's finish this last slide reading aloud. One, forgive at both decisional and emotional levels. Two, bury what you forgive in a cemetery without headstones, or float it away, or do something else. Number three, let go of the five R's. Recalling, ruminating, resenting, rehearsing, and reheating for dinner. And four, prosper and be in good health. So I ask you, can you really afford to be unforgiving?